From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and advisor to Protect Democracy, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization formed in 2016 to prevent American democracy from declining into a more authoritarian form of government. She is a nationally recognized TV commentator on fascism, authoritarian leaders, and propaganda, and the threats these present to democracies. Professor Ben-Ghiat is the author or editor of 6 books, the most recent of which is entitled Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present, which examines how illiberal leaders use corruption, violence, propaganda, and machismo to stay in power, and how resistance to them has unfolded over a century. In her online newsletter, Lucid, about democracy and autocracy, Ruth Ben-Ghiat says, quote, democracy is in decline. Over half of the world's population now lives under some form of illiberal rule. Wherever democracy deteriorates, so does support for transparency and accountability. Disinformation about current events thrives, as do versions of history that cover up authoritarian crimes, unquote. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Professor Ben-Ghiat about the decline in democracy and rise of authoritarian leaders and movements around the world, from Italy, Sweden, Hungary, and Russia to the United States and even Brazil. Ruth Ben-Ghiat joins us via Zoom. Ruth, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, Ruth, before we get into specifics, what are the fundamental hallmarks of authoritarianism, which of course has a long history, and where do you see them manifesting themselves in the world most egregiously?
So at its most basic, authoritarianism is a political system where the executive branch and the leader overwhelms the independent judiciary, has an iron control of parliament, controls the press. And in classic authoritarian states of the 20th century, you had dictatorships where you just had one party and no opposition press allowed. And these still exist in North Korea and China. But today, there's a different model for authoritarianism where leaders come to power by elections, and then they keep elections going, but they game the system. So they have a veneer of democracy. Orban in Hungary calls it illiberal democracy. But there's not much democratic in the end about such systems either.
I'm certainly glad you brought up the topic of elections and how far-right leaders use that as a cover. And we'll get into that in a bit. But one other general question, how should we distinguish among terms like authoritarianism, ultranationalism, and fascism? Are they a part of a continuum or spectrum of anti-democratic far-right movements?
Yeah, they are. I wrote my book, Strong Men, to unpack all of this. And so the playbook invented by fascism is still with us today, most notably in things like the leader cult, the use of rallies, indoctrination, violence, and genocidal campaigns, imperialist wars. But fascism was the first stage of authoritarianism, along with early communism. And during the 20th century, you had, you know, military dictatorships of the Cold War, and now you have what are called electoral autocracies. As I said before, you keep elections going, but you find ways to rig the system so you get the results that you need. And so in a way, the book was a way to look at what has changed and what stays the same from the beginning with fascism.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat, I'd like now to turn to Italy. Italians have just elected a new leader, Giorgia Meloni, whose party, the Brothers of Italy, has its origins in the fascist party of Benito Mussolini, about which you have written. It's a continuation of success of other far-right parties from France, Germany, Sweden more recently, and Hungary. What do you think are the main factors that led to Meloni and her party and other far-right parties' victory?
Yeah, that's a great question. On the one hand, this vote in Italy was a protest vote against other parties, in particular, the center-left, the main Democratic Party, which has not done a very good job of seeming to respond to voters' concerns about the economy. It's viewed as very elitist, as very establishment. So we're in a period more generally of discontent with existing political solutions. And Democratic parties with a small D have struggled to find a way of responding to the challenge posed by the global right. And the global right is very organized in transnational networks. Meloni is very close with Orban. She used to be close with Putin till it wasn't convenient to be close with Putin. She's very close with the American GOP, and they have consolidated their talking points, their enemies, from George Soros to Democrats and liberals on the left. And they're very effective at using emotions, mostly negative emotions, the idea of victimization, that the nation is preyed upon by forces. During the fascist years, it was the League of Nations. It's always been the Jews. It's always been the left for right-wing authoritarians. Today, it's George Soros. It's the EU. It's NATO. So this idea that they use emotions to present themselves as the protector of the people in ways that Democrats don't. And so this has proved very effective in a period where many people feel struggling to keep up economically. Disinformation has made them very wary of immigrants. This idea of great replacement theory weaponizes fear that they're going to be extinguished by others. So the right has been extremely successful in leveraging people's darkest emotions and fears. And that, along with the weakness of alternatives, is why there's been this success.
And Ruth Benguiat, let's talk about some of the values and policies that would flow from the Italian Brothers of Italy and its allies, the anti-immigrant sentiment, xenophobia. Talk a bit about that as well.
So Meloni and her party, Brothers of Italy, as I said, it's very immersed in the far right European and American scene. And so anti-immigration, the idea that immigration is a threat to white Christian identity, would translate into policies that we already saw in Italy with Meloni's governing coalition, includes the racist League party of Matteo Salvini, who was charged criminally for turning back boats of immigrants in the Mediterranean, resulting in loss of life and human rights violations. And Meloni herself, there's video of her saying that no mosques should ever be built in Italy again. She's highly nationalist, highly xenophobic. So we can expect a very hard line on immigration. We can expect an increase of hate crimes of every sort, because wherever the right comes to power, there is an increase in hate crimes against people who are not white and Christian. And she very clearly defines Italian heritage as only white and Christian. She's different, though, than all the other far-right leaders in Europe and America, in that she has direct contact to historic fascism. And her party, Brothers of Italy, was established in 2012 because at the time there was no autonomous extreme right party. And the existing party had fused with Berlusconi's party. There wasn't an autonomous extreme right party. But she grew up in the original neo-fascist party. She's only in her mid-40s, but this party existed for many, many years. And she wasn't just a member. She was a hardcore fascist militant, and that's important. She became the head of the youth organization, which was a big deal. And the logo of her current party includes a tricolor flame. And now she's saying she's a conservative, and that logo is just the colors of the flag of Italy. But that logo and that flame, that was the symbol of the original neo-fascist party, which was formed when Mussolini was killed and the original party was banned. So she insisted on keeping that flame there because she saw her mission to carry forth the ideals of neo-fascism into the present.
Well, indeed, and she will be the first female prime minister in Italy. And as you said, the leader of the most far-right government since the fascist era, I think that should inspire fear. And as a result, how worried should we be? How worried should Europe be, notwithstanding there are so many other far-right parties that are gaining ground, as I said, in Sweden. Of course, France is legendary with Marine Le Pen. We have Hungary, Fidesz. How worried should we be, though, about this recent development in Italy?
I mean, quite worried, because on the one hand, she's no fool, which is how she got to where she is. And she has been advertising herself not only as a conservative, but as a good Atlanticist. She's been muting her years of anti-EU talk. So she's really trying to have a reputational rehabilitation to appeal to a more centrist constituencies, not only in Italy, but in Europe. And we'll have to see who she appoints. The government's still in formation, but who she appoints as finance minister, for example, as labor minister, who she appoints to be ambassador to the EU, et cetera, all these will signal if she's going to indeed be an Atlanticist or she's going to be a kind of anti-European radical. And we'll have to see. But I want to call attention to the fact that although she keeps saying she's a conservative, she had to ban public celebrations of her party. It was a big deal that they got 26% of the vote. And so in Italy, having a public celebration in the piazza is the most natural thing in the world. But she banned them. Why? Because her party is indeed full of fascists and skinheads. And there was too much risk that they were going to be doing fascist salutes and calling, you know, Vive il Duce, calling out to Mussolini. And she can't have that be seen. That would ruin her reputation and her image. So she's being very careful to manage the image of her party. And so we'll have to see what things look like once the government is appointed.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She's professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. She writes the online newsletter Lucid on Substack. And her latest book is Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voaafrica.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Hupto Manji from the town of Birinkebi in northwestern Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Ruth Ben-Ghiat. And Ruth, we were talking about Italy, Giorgia Meloni. But as we said, we're seeing a similar trend of far-right successes throughout Europe. In mid-September, the Swedish voters delivered a rather narrow victory to a loose coalition of right-wing parties, including the populist party Sweden Democrats. It has ultra-nationalist extremism roots in neo-Nazism. So many of these parties, you know, are moving from the fringes now to center stage. We're seeing also right-wing parties, populist parties in Spain, Vox, Chega in Portugal. And so I guess the big question is, especially given the war in Ukraine, what impact will these far-right parties have, and particularly Italy, with respect to Europe's support for Ukraine against the aggressor Russia, given that Putin's Russia has so many ties to these far-right parties, financing them in Europe, etc.?
Yeah, this is a kind of existential crisis and moment for the whole far right, because Putin indeed has been funding these parties, and not only very close to Matteo Salvini in Italy in this League party, but Berlusconi, who unbelievably is back in government in some way, likely, and he's part of the governing coalition. He was, after Gerhard Schröder in Germany, Berlusconi was for over a decade a true Putin mouthpiece, which is what the American ambassador to Italy called him. They were very, very close. And he not only, Berlusconi, brought fascists into the government for the first time since 1945, clearing the way for the things we're seeing today that you just described, but also made it his business to push Putin's interest in Europe up through the defense of the aggressions in Georgia in 2008 and blaming NATO and blaming the US. And so since then, Putin has not only financed the right-wing parties, he's also made it his mission to destroy democracy. He's funded secessionist causes and movements around the world. He's very close with the American GOP. It was a huge gift, you know, that Trump came into office, which the Russians helped with that in many, many ways, their support of that. And so now that he is clearly in trouble and his regime is, I believe, starting to destabilize because of his very ill-advised war, all that he has built and the whole universe of anti-democratic far-right networks and parties and financial arrangements, all of that is a little bit at stake. Now, one thing that's happened, though, is that as Putin's become more toxic, other figures have emerged. And one of them is Viktor Orban, who has asserted himself in Budapest as a hub of the far right, this kind of new political cultural order. And so you see a very intense amount of activity with, for example, the American GOP, which is in this far right Euro-American order, fits in very nicely, where the Americans have their conferences in Budapest and Orban comes there. He's very close with Meloni. And so as Putin's star dims, Orban's rises. Now, Orban doesn't have the money to finance the right. He's a client of Putin, but he has all the other types of authority to step in.
No question. And since you've brought up the United States, the Republican Party, we might as well just segue right into that and come back to Europe. Because what we're seeing here in the United States is a wholesale remaking of the Republican Party in former President Trump's image. And that is very different from what the traditional Republican values reflected. It's far more akin to, like you said, fascist or neo-fascist values. There's this convergence on certain themes like strong anti-immigrant sentiment, as if immigrants are potentially going to take over, replace, right? The replacement theory, the white race, this interest in keeping a majority white Christian population. Talk about what we're seeing here in the United States, particularly as it has been amplified by former President Trump and continues to be as a result of the insurrection on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, which he certainly instigated. It's clear, and that he wanted to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power. And many Republican members of Congress and others seem to have bought into this, what we have been calling in this country, the big lie that he won the 2020 election when, of course, he did not.
Yeah, it's very sad for me as a first-generation American to watch what's going on in this country. And because I studied fascism and autocracy for so long, I was one of the very first people to start writing about Trump as an authoritarian in 2015-16. And it's absolutely astonishing the speed with which Trump came in from outside of politics and domesticated the GOP and imposed a kind of authoritarian discipline on it and acted like an autocratic president up through fulfilling what I write in my book about these strongmen is that they never leave office voluntarily. They just won't. It's like a psychological death for them. And they also are deathly afraid of their own corruption and prosecution. So true to type, Trump, he had the complicity of a large part of the GOP because he'd been so successful domesticating them. And he had a coup attempt. And I want to point out that it's extremely rare in history that a failed self-coup, because this is a self-coup, technically was in office trying to stay there. And these terms come from the Spanish, like autogolpe. It's very rare that someone who has a failed self-coup is still hanging around as a viable politician. Almost everybody has to go into exile or something else happens to them. And indeed, not only is Trump there, but he's thinking of running for office again. So we are really in uncharted terrain. And the big story is the remaking of the GOP as an autocratic party. And it's simply astonishing the speed at which this is now happening, where anybody who's moderate or does not support Trump, who again hasn't been in office for a long time, but still has his personality cult intact, is pushed out. And very unfortunately, tragically, the people who are encouraged to run for office now are lawless people, including members of anti-government extremist organizations like the Oath Keepers. So the qualities in a politician in the United States now, what are they? They're people who pose in their campaign ads with assault rifles. They're people who breach the Capitol. They're criminals, some of them. And this is, unfortunately, in syntony with what happens in authoritarian regimes where, for example, in Modi's India in 2019, the sitting legislators included, 10 people who had open cases for murder charges. Since the Nazis, they've known how important it is to get criminals into government because they can help spread corruption and help spread violence. And it's very sad to me that this is happening and scary that this is happening in America now.
Yes. And just a quick follow-up, the United States has for decades, maybe, more than a century, been seen as a beacon for people around the world, a beacon of democracy. And now we're in this place where perhaps we are no longer that beacon. I mean, even President Biden warned against these tendencies and that democracy is indeed at stake. And some say it is really on the ballot here for November midterm elections, not just the economy, not just reproductive rights in the wake of the overturning of the Roe versus Wade decision. So how serious a moment is this in your view, not just for the U.S. and for us as Americans, for the future of our country, but also as an example to the world? We are supposed to be a symbol. Do you think we can somehow overcome this dangerous moment?
Yeah, the midterms are a very grave moment for our country because there are hundreds of election deniers running. And these are people who not only have agreed in a corrupt fashion to say that Trump won the election and not Biden, but election denial now has been institutionalized as party dogma. This is why one of the many indexes or criteria we could say that the GOP is an authoritarian party. They will not concede defeat. They will not respect the laws of democratic transitions of power in their own contests, in their own state or local races. So you have hundreds of politicians who will refuse to leave. They will refuse to leave office if they are incumbents, or if they're running for office and the other person wins, they'll refuse to accept the results, creating crisis after crisis. And this is now again, hundreds of these people are taking over the electoral system. Now, why does this matter? It matters because this paralyzes the system of democracy, which is built on a faith in elections, but it also sends a message to other countries because what happens in America matters a lot abroad. And so we've already seen that, look what's happened in Brazil with Bolsonaro, who has modeled himself on Trump. It's a little colonialist. I don't like the phrase Trump of the tropics, but there are huge and very intensive ties between the Bolsonaro family and the Trump family. And Bolsonaro clearly took this kind of big lie script from Trump. And the other reason it matters is that the United States had the military and financial power to sanction, to have be the shepherd of regimes of sanctions against human rights violators and kleptocrats. And if the United States becomes a kind of autocratic country, then what happens to all of that? What happens to human rights? What happens to anti-corruption measures, of which many have been passed in Congress in the last years? And of course, Trump would shut down and probably go after the people in charge of the January 6th investigation and any investigations, as well as the media. And this has reverberations all over the world.
Indeed. And so we're seeing faith in elections and faith in objective facts, as if that sounds like a redundancy. But because we are treated to all sorts of propaganda and false narratives parading as facts, this is what we're seeing. And these are common denominators of these far right groups. And unfortunately, as you said, the Republican Party has been emulating these tendencies, or who knows who's emulating whom. But nonetheless, yes. Talk about the role of propaganda, false narratives, this sense that only we are right, whether that's Putin in Russia, Viktor Orban in Hungary, or Donald Trump in the United States, or Bolsonaro, you know, in Brazil.
Yeah, one of the things that surprised me when I wrote Strongman, which has a chapter on propaganda that goes over 100 years, was how many things have stayed the same. And for example, personality cults, the leader cults, and they're very, very important. They are the glue of propaganda because they all say that the leader is a man of the people. That's the populist part. And these men are very skilled propagandists who have a direct connection with the population, an unmediated connection. And that's how they build loyalty and they build their charisma. They become stars and poll stars for people. And so Mussolini used newsreels and Hitler had the radio, you know, all of his ranting touched an emotional chord. And then today Trump had Twitter, as well as they all use rallies. So this is very important. So they're a man of the people. And they connect with people, but they're also a man above all other men, and they're infallible. They're omnipotent. So Mussolini's slogan was, Mussolini is always right. And Trump has said many of the same things, right? So this kind of regime propaganda with the emblem being the leader is very important. Now, that one difference is the Kremlin information warfare playbook, which has been exported all over the world, including to America. And Trump's a good example of someone using an information warfare playbook, as is Steve Bannon, is that it's not only about certitudes and saying there's only one truth. Nowadays, the goal is to confuse people, to get them to realize that there is no truth, that you can't ever know the truth. And so you have conspiracy theories, and QAnon is really big in the United States. You have just a suspension of the ability to ever know what's going on. And you have the volume of rumor. And so people who study propaganda, it's called the Russian fire hose of falsehood, because the volume is very important today. It exhausts people and they give up trying to know what's going on. And if you're a corrupt, repressive autocrat, you don't want people to be fresh and able to investigate you. It's easier to just have people give up. So that's one thing that's different today.
Yes. And of course, we're seeing in this country political violence unleashed by Trump's conspiracy theories about the 2020 election. They're amplified on right-wing cable news and talk radio. So people can no longer distinguish between truth and fiction, although they should be able to do so. And I guess that's just another symptom of social media platforms, people not checking where their information is coming from and just being brainwashed or allowing themselves to be brainwashed. So back to Russia and how we see Europe going forward, given the need for supporting Ukraine. Many are saying that Ukraine really is the bastion or their symbol of fighting for democracy, the survival of democracy in Europe. And how do you see this moment, this sort of standoff between Russia and its influence with these far-right parties and the tendency for these far-right parties to agree, you know, with Putin's worldview and the survival and the future of the transatlantic alliance?
Yeah, it's clear that the fight for Ukraine is the fight for democracy all over the world. And yet we have a textbook example of what I call autocratic backfire, because the way this war has not gone well for Putin flies in the face of what we talked about before, this investment in making the leader untouchable, infallible, omnipotent. And Putin in particular, he's the only leader since Mussolini who posed so much without his shirt on. This machismo, very important machismo in the authoritarian playbook. And all of that is now called into doubt, because when leaders have been in power for too long, they become not only paranoid, like Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, they stop listening to any critics. They have an inner circle that shrinks. So they start to make bad decisions. And I think that Putin saw that he was at his peak. His popularity was declining. He's not getting any younger. And he decided to do what many autocrats have done in the past, have some grand gesture that would secure his place in history. So 3 days after the war started, I wrote an opinion piece for MSNBC saying that this wasn't going to go well at all. And I'm not a career Russia expert, but everything I said in the piece has happened because I'm an autocrat expert. So Putin did not game out this war with his economic advisors, who were experts on sanctions, because they had the example of Crimea, which in 2014, he annexed Crimea, there were sanctions. He didn't consult them. He didn't really consult with most of his military. And the other thing we see is the astonishment that almost everyone, you know, U.S. foreign military advisors themselves have been astonished by the terrible performance of the Russian military. But I saw immediately that this is the effect of corruption, because Russia is a kleptocracy. And every time we mention Russia and we don't mention that it's kleptocracy, we are failing to get at the essence of authoritarianism, which is plunder of state institutions. Putin has jailed between 70 and 100,000 businessmen. And all the institutions, including the military, are ravaged by this corruption. And this is the result of institutionalized lying. Everyone's afraid to speak out or they'll fall out of a window. And so all the pathologies of autocracy are actually on display for the world. And we can learn from this. And in fact, it's a very dangerous moment, because autocrats who think they're going down and have been embarrassed and humiliated to the world are highly dangerous, which, because of nuclear weapons, become existential threats.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Ruth, thank you so much for for your terrific insights. We greatly appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.